Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Well, who hasn't heard of Louis L'Amour? The American novelist and short story writer left a legacy of books consisting primarily of Western novels, although he called his work Frontier Stories. His published and unpublished work has been managed by his son, Beau, since 1988. Now, think there's no more to read from Louis L'Amour? Well, you'd be wrong. So my guest today is Beau L'Amour. He's a writer and entertainment industry jack of all trades. He's author of Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures, Volume 1. And the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places, including the website louislamour.com. And you can follow on Facebook, Instagram, X, and YouTube. And Beau, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Now, on the off chance, and this does happen where any of my listeners or viewers may not know about Louis L'Amour, although I doubt it, give us your perspective from a son's view of the importance of Louis L'Amour and why you have been very much involved in maintaining his legacy.
Well, Dad was, for a good deal of the latter half of the 20th century, I'd say pretty much all of the latter half of the 20th century, one of the best-selling writers in the United States, if not the world. He sold, to date, somewhere in the neighborhood of 330 million copies. And probably more important, none of his books have ever gone out of print. And year on year, our sales are still in probably the top 50 authors in the world. So that's completely separate from the 330 million. It's just like, as of every year in competition with all other authors, we're still up in the top 50. So it's pretty amazing for, you know, a man who passed away, you know, over 30 years ago.
It is. And the other thing that fascinated me about Louis L'Amour, and I grew up knowing about Louis L'Amour, is that the name Louis L'Amour in Westerns, it just doesn't seem to be a synergy there with the name and his subject matter, but somehow it works.
Well, his family came from Canada, so there was a certain French influence. And, you know, there were plenty of editors back in the pulp magazine days who said you would never sell a Western with a name like Louis L'Amour. So he briefly wrote under a couple of other names, but all of that material is today published as Louis L'Amour. So,
right. Well, that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I would imagine when he first started, again, that disconnect between the name and the West in that sense. Why did he pick the West? What was it about the American West that intrigued your father?
It's kind of interesting. He didn't really pick it out of intrigue. So he started as a writer in the pulp magazines. He started off writing a kind of personal adventure stories, very much a la Ernest Hemingway, who was kind of getting started right around the same time. I don't know if they were aware of one another or not, but they were writing similar type material. He was never really able to make that stuff sell particularly well, and he transitioned into the pulp magazines, where he wrote crime stories and high adventure, think like kind of Indiana Jones type stuff. He wrote sports stories, a lot of stories that dealt with boxing and the corruption in the boxing world, things like that. And in a couple, only one or two Westerns prior to World War II. World War II rolled around, the publishing industry changed tremendously as he came out of the military. And my dad, like a lot of other authors, like a lot of the audience, seemed to sense this thing. Maybe it was, he wrote high adventure before the war. After the war, many guys had been to Burma. Many guys had been to North Africa. They had seen their friends die there. It wasn't fun anymore. And so the adventure genre came home, back to the United States, comfortably at home and comfortably in the past. And it was an easier way, maybe, for veterans or a country that was sick of war to deal with the adventure genre. And so after the war, he had already started writing Westerns, but he had an editor at a particular magazine suggest that was a good idea. And they sold very well until the pulp magazine business collapsed and he had to remake himself writing paperback originals in the mid 1950s.
Given the length and breadth of his career, when he first started writing, was it by pen or pencil and then typewriter and then other forms of technology? Or how many, how many?
It was always a typewriter. He hunted and pecked, two fingers on a typewriter, and his handwriting was better than mine, but not that good. So that wasn't a good way of communicating with the world.
Did he wear out any of the typewriters, or he kept one the whole time?
He moved through typewriters, but I think he used about six in his career. He used six or seven typewriters. I actually have them sitting on either side of me
I was about to ask you, yes, and whether
right here.
you have a great.
I actually use them when I need to date a manuscript. I'll put a sheet of paper in the typewriter and I will type out that manuscript. And if the errors in the type level and spacing and everything look the same, then I know which typewriter he wrote it on, and that means I know what era he wrote it in.
That's great. It's sort of reverse engineering in a way.
Yeah, kind of forensics.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it must be interesting from your perspective. You have your own career, and yet you are surrounded by your father's works, including the typewriters. So you're committed to this, preserving his legacy and expanding it actually as well. Did you make a conscious decision to do that at some point along the way?
Oh, pretty much the moment he passed away. Yeah, it was. I've worked around the pub. I had already worked around the publishing business quite a bit, and I knew that a writer dies, you generally have a burst of popularity, and then kind of a collapse of the career, and generally that all happens within about 5 years. And my dad had only become particularly well known in the latter part of his life. It was only really in the mid 70s that he became super popular. So he had about 10 years, maybe 12 years of great popularity out of a very long career. And of course, I wanted to keep that going for our own family reasons financially, but I also wanted to keep it going for my dad because, he hadn't had all that long to enjoy it.
I think the exception to your rule would be Shakespeare.
Oh, there are a few outstanding writers that just go on and on and on. And some, in my dad's day, the person to outsell was Agatha Christie. All right. So she had just sold unbelievable number of stories and everything. And continuing on after her death, it lasted more than 5 years. But today, it's hard, you can certainly find an Agatha Christie book thanks to Amazon. But you go to a bookstore and they're not necessarily spread all over the mystery section like they used to be.
Sure. I want to talk to you about Lost Treasures, Volume 1 and Volume 2 in a moment, but just kind of to flesh out your background and your dedication. You were in the entertainment business, as I mentioned, and you made this commitment to preserve and expand your dad's legacy. When you're working on his works, which sounds redundant, but it's not, when you're working on his works, do you have a connection that you find with him through his works that is either the same or different from your connection with him as a son?
Yes, I mean his. I would, in a lot of ways, while I've been very instrumental in dealing with the things that he wrote and stuff like that, I always feel like, people are great fans of his and everything else. But having known the guy, I kind of feel like his work was sort of the least of him. He was a really exceptional human being, and I really appreciate the time that, we had together. When I work on his material, it's also just like working on material. I try to do it relatively dispassionately and not get connected to something because he was my father or something of the sort. I try to bring the same sort of intensity that I would bring to working on anybody else's material.
Sure, because of your background in publishing, you could approach it a little objectively, or a little bit more objectively than I would think some sons would be able to do with their fathers who are famous authors in that sense. What impresses me is the fact that we know of writers and artists who you have to separate out sometimes the art from the person, because sometimes it could be a nasty piece of work, but create great works of art. What's nice to know is that your dad was much more than just writing all these books. He was a father and a husband, and he had a full life. So it's good to hear that from his son.
He often joked that he wouldn't be remembered because he wasn't a drunk and he didn't, you know, beat his children. It's like this is like, there's like, nobody's ever going to know who I was because, you know, I didn't live an infamous life.
So it sounds like he had a great sense of humor.
Definitely.
Yeah. Is it hard as you're serving in a dual capacity, your son and also the executor in the sense of managing his estate, his literary estate. And I'm going to talk to you again in just a moment about Lost Treasures, Volume 1 and 2. But when you're doing all of that, do you find yourself subsumed into that world, or do you still have a sense of your own Beau identity?
Oh, I definitely have a sense of my own identity, but that world is really the fundamental of my career these days. And I'm very happy to have it that way. If I was still 30 years old and trying to impress girls or something, I might be more like, oh, I've got to do my own thing and everything else. But, you know, those days are past and I don't necessarily need that any longer.
I think you said something very significant. You said a fundamental part of your career as opposed to your life. So you're able to split those two and still enjoy the now at the same time you're working in the past.
Yeah, but I mean, it's now. I mean, I have an old sports car. I go out and drive that or whatever, you know. It's kind of, there's all kinds of things I like to, you know, I like to do. But work's a big part of it. I enjoy it as much as it's important for many other reasons.
Well, let's talk about Lost Treasures Volume 1. And also there's Volume 2. This is a mix of mysterious stories and lost notes and unfinished manuscripts. Tell us how you came about packaging this unusual Volume 1 and, of course, Volume 2.
Well, my dad was relatively neat and disciplined about every part of his life except his office, which became just mired in paper. We always used to joke that it wasn't important where something was. What was important is what it was under. And it was quite a large room, but ultimately there was this narrow path between kind of hip high piles of paper and books and stuff that led to his desk. And that was kind of it. It was just this morass of paper. And so when he passed away, one of the first things, I mean, the thing that really projected me into this lifestyle was the fact that somebody had to get in there and clean it up and make some kind of sense of it. So I spent several years doing that. And in doing so, I found a bunch of manuscripts, which we published in the years following. Those were finished stories or mostly finished stories. And then there were a whole bunch of fragments of things, stories that my dad had started and for one reason or another not finished, stories that there were sometimes multiple drafts, and you could see him trying to work it to the point where it would just take off and he would finish it. Dad very rarely, he never really wrote multiple drafts of an entire work. So he would sometimes write, he would like roll up to trying to get started many times, but he wouldn't necessarily write, you know, draft 1, 2, 3, 4 of a finished work. So I had a bunch of that stuff and thought it was really fascinating, especially as I was then able to go back through his correspondence, through his journals, through many, many interviews that I've done with people who knew him, and kind of discover the story of what these stories were supposed to be, how they were supposed to end, what they were supposed to do for his career, what position in his career he thought they were supposed to take. And so in Lost Treasures Volume 1, the book, I take about 40 of those pieces, and some of them are finished, some of them are not, but I put them in there, and I sometimes will show you a couple of drafts and explain what he's trying to work out. Sometimes I'll take a number of drafts and coalesce them into one kind of best of version. And then I'll explain where he was going and what he was trying to do with it, or what was going on in his life. Why did he get stopped? There's many different stories. And in doing so, it was fascinating because I learned a great deal about his life, kind of drilling down on this. It became very obvious that he came out of the pulps. He wrote in all these different genres. He was able to make a hit in Westerns and stuck with that until he had established himself pretty well, right around the time of my birth. And then he wanted to branch out and get back into writing other genres and got a lot of pushback from the publishers. They wanted him to stick with writing Westerns. And of course, he had a family to support. He was not yet particularly popular. Since he needed to keep doing that, he stuck with the Westerns, but he started to develop this plan of like, okay, nobody else wants me to, they don't want me to go back to writing crime. They don't want me to go back to writing adventure. I'd love to write some science fiction, but nobody wants me to do that. So I'm going to start stretching the Western genre to the point where it begins to accommodate some of these things and just becomes a wider vision of what it had been. And the Western genre was very brittle in the 50s and 60s. I mean, it was just post-Civil War only, cattle drives. Miners were like, that was weird. I mean, that was considered odd. You know, the idea that somebody might do a book about mountain men, yeah, once in a while, a book about railroad surveyors in the days before the Civil War, crazy. That would be just almost unacceptable. He wrote a book called Shalico, which was about a European safari, hunting safari in the West. And oh my God, the blowback he got from that, you know, it was just not something that was accepted in Westerns. And so he kept kind of pushing the envelope very, very, very gently over about 20 years and finally succeeded in that. And, you know, maybe opened it up for other people too, let's hope. But that process and that plan became very clear as I worked on this book. And it was really kind of a fascinating discovery that he'd had this giant vision for what he was doing and for the whole genre.
So you weren't really aware of his foresight until you started going through all that paper.
He would say stuff occasionally. But I didn't get it. I didn't put it together as a, you know, I was 28 when he died. Many of these things I heard at younger ages as a teenager, I would hear him say something, but I wasn't necessarily doing this big connect the dots. Oh, my dad has got this kind of complex imperial plan for changing the Western genre or something like this. And he was doing it so gently, that it wasn't entirely, you know, it wasn't incredibly obvious to, I think, anybody. And so anyway, after doing the Lost Treasures Volume 1 book, I've also taken a whole bunch of his older novels and added a postscript in the back of maybe 30 plus of those that does the same thing. That says, here's this book. Here's, you know, a novel that you love, but here's the story behind it. Here's how he did the research on it. Here's how this story came to be because he had a friendship with Katharine Hepburn and, you know, various other things like that. And so I was able to, you know, do the making of or the story behind the story of a whole bunch of his work. If you take it all, Lost Treasures Volume 1, Lost Treasures Volume 2, all the postscripts, a thing I'll tell you about in a minute, a novel called No Traveler Returns. If you take all of the Lost Treasures series and you put it together, it really becomes like the professional biography of Louis L'Amour. It's not necessarily his life and all the details that happened in his personal life, but if you want to deal with just the writing and just the career, and of course, it's a wonderful way to do it because it's these things are right there with the writing. I don't have to, if I'm writing a separate book, I would have to synopsize the novel and then talk about it and everything. And I don't have to do that. It's right there with the novel. So it's was a great experience. The last thing I was mentioning, No Traveler Returns, is if we went back to that kind of Hemingway type style that he wrote in early in his career, he started writing a novel that was part of the sequence of stories that he was writing at that time. I kind of jokingly call it Louis L'Amour 1.0. Sort of a picture of the world in the 1920s and 30s when he was traveling around the world, working in different places, going to sea, things like that. And that novel was kind of an unfinished pile of chapters. He stuck it in a trunk when he was drafted into the military and never revisited it. And I tried to go in and again, kind of forensically recreate a finished work that was exactly the way he would have put it together if he'd been able to put it together as part of that trajectory of stories.
And you have the advantage of having that publishing background. So it's not as if you're approaching it as a neophyte. You have some background to be able to look at this and organize it properly.
I worked in an office down the hall from Ian Ballantyne, who brought Penguin to the United States in the 1950s. I mean, he was like the first paperback guy in America. I was working in the 1980s, but remarkably, some of the original guys who started the paperback business were still in operation. And I wonderfully got to know them. And of course, they all knew my dad. So it wasn't sort of, who the hell are you kind of thing.
It does help to have the name. Yes.
Yeah.
You also mentioned coming into his office after his death, and it was a lot of clutter, but it was profitable clutter. It wasn't just clutter for clutter's sake. He obviously was working on books and manuscripts, etc. So when you go into the office, I didn't ask this earlier, but I just thought of it. Was his office at home? Did he work at home?
Yes.
And did most authors at that time work from home? They didn't have a separate office to go to, or he found it much more productive to walk down the hall and go into the office and write.
I think being able to get to work right away was very important. And also more important than that, until the mid to late 1970s, he didn't have the money to allow himself to have an extra, another piece of real estate, or the rental of an office or something like that. That wasn't financially possible.
That's the amazing thing to me, is that your father, who was a prolific writer, you think at some level that they're making all this kind of money to be able to not only support their family, but to have a nice home and also to have a nice office somewhere and a secretary and an assistant, et cetera. But it shows you that, in fact, sometimes it's just the love of the work that is the most important thing.
Or the love of your family, or maybe that's the only thing you can do. I mean, in my dad's case, it might have been the only real skill that he had. I mean, most of the other work he did in his life was physical labor. And he, I would say until, probably until he met my mother, I don't think there was a year that he made $5,000. And at the beginning of during the time when the pulp magazines were collapsing and he was trying to find some way of getting a career started in paperback originals, he was living in a room in the back of some other people's apartment, and he was going to the park every morning and sitting in the park at breakfast time. So the lady that was renting him the room wouldn't realize he didn't have the money to have breakfast. So it was, dad had to write 4 novels a year for us to live a, moderately well, middle-class lifestyle.
A comfortable life. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we'd got a new car if he sold a movie. I tell this story very often because I can remember it so well. We had an old Cadillac that had been bought before I was born. And I remember, I was probably about 8, and my mom and I were we walked down to the driveway. Someone had bought the car and they were driving it down the street towards Sunset Boulevard, and we were just like going, just keep going. Get this wreck out of here. It had about 300,000 miles on it. And we were both just saying, oh, you got to keep going because it's going to fall apart.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. The you mentioned earlier Katharine Hepburn, and your dad must have known a lot of famous people, not necessarily movie stars per se, but literary giants as well. Can you give us a sense of some of the people he knew, some of his contemporaries?
it wasn't, you know, he didn't have a lot of friends who were writers, but he spent, you know, he didn't drive. So he would get out on the streets of Los Angeles and be walking around, and he would run into the other person who famously didn't drive, Ray Bradbury. And the two of them would stroll from bookstore to bookstore in Beverly Hills.
Right.
Or they would go to a coffee shop and call my mother to pick them up and take them somewhere. So there was, you know, there was some of that, but he knew a lot of very interesting people. And some of them were in the arts, but I would say the close relationships, he was close with Alan Ladd and close with Alan Ladd's family. They're almost members of my mother's family. There were other kind of interesting celebrity type people. I met an awful lot of fascinating people when I was young, but they weren't necessarily show business people.
Good to know. Before I let you go, two things. One is, since they have the Bradbury building, maybe it's time for the L'Amour building. And that's one thought that occurs to me. But also, what do you want people to take away from the volume one and volume two of Lost Treasures, volume one and volume two, Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures? What would you like people to take away?
It's kind of an education in what being a writer in the 20th century was like. I like that. There's a sense of what my father was really like in all of his eclectic interests, because the material, it's not a book full of fragments of Westerns. There's all kinds of strange, wonderful stories about reincarnation, stories about China, stories about all kinds of amazing things in that book. So the breadth of his interests is something I would really like to communicate, because he's particularly known as an author of Westerns. And the mystery of it, one of the things I didn't try to do was to organize it too carefully, because I discovered those things randomly. And every time I did, it was like picking up another facet of his personality and examining it. And it was just, there was just this sense of kind of exploring and discovering and learning things that you had never known before about a person that you thought you knew pretty well. And I think that there was just an incredible aspect of that to that work. And I think, you know, it's a frustrating read if you're reading it for the stories, because in many of the cases you get into the story and it clips off after a couple of chapters, and maybe you'll be satisfied by my saying, oh, and here's an outline about where the rest of it would have gone, but it's not there. So it's really, you know, you're reading to discover the life of a writer.
That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Beau L'Amour. He's author of Louis L'Amour's Lost Treasures, Volume 1 and Volume 2. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the usual places, including the website, louislamour.com. louislamour.com. You can follow on Facebook, Instagram, X, and YouTube. And Beau, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.